Welcome everyone to this week's FBOA in Conversation. This week I have with me Mr. Max Breed. Mr. Breed is a partner at Warshaw Burstein, where he represents businesses and individuals in real estate and commercial matters with a focus on guiding strategy for real estate portfolios and interests. He graduated from Fordham University School of Law in 2006. Welcome, Max. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I am great. So, Max, I read in your biography, you handle a lot of litigation and real estate matters. Was real estate something that you always wanted to do, or was that something that you happened upon later in your career?
I would characterize it as more by accident than by design. When I was in college, I studied English. I thought that I might want to be an academic, a professor, and then I found myself in law school after graduation. And at that point in time, I was a little bit rudderless, I guess. And, you know, I had things that interested me, but wasn't quite sure, what to make of a career. And it happened that my contacts in my personal life were in the real estate industry. And so as a result of that, the first two positions that I had at firms, first at Cadwalader during the summer after my first year, and then at a boutique real estate shop after my second year, and then after graduation, you know, were through contacts that I had just in my personal life. And as a result of that, I found myself interested in that area, and that turned out to be a good decision, because having those contacts meant that I then later had to book a business. And that's the critical thing, when you reach a certain point in the career, you have to be able to build book.
Right. So can you explain what building book means? Because I'm sure law students have heard that term, but maybe don't really want to ask what that might actually mean.
I think the best way to explain that is this. It's easy enough to get a job and be a cog in a machine. Right. And to take whatever firm matters are given to you and to show up for work and work whatever hours you have to, bill whatever hours you have to. But I think the trick for many attorneys is learning how to be entrepreneurial and how to develop one's own clients and how to develop business and to become, less an employee and more a professional who advises clients and ends up building business and building book, as I said, through referrals and relationships. And, that's really, I think, as far as the practice of law goes, what I enjoy most is that advisory work, which is really based upon relationships. And my largest clients my largest client is based on relationships that go back now 20 years, since I was in college. And essentially, I work, with an organization's principles, based on that. And that's a really wonderful place to be in, where you have this sort of partnership, with an outside business, and they in turn partner with you. But that's how I think, fundamentally, for anybody who is going to go, especially in, smaller or mid-sized firm practice, having this depth of relationships and, this book that's more than just something that a firm gifts or gives you. It's all based on relationships and logging that Rolodex as time goes on.
Right. As I've told other students that I've talked to, one of the things that I think is really important in law school and also before law school and college is make friends, try and network now with the people you know, because you never know when they will come back into your life or when you might be calling upon them or they might be calling upon you. So I always think that's really important, and I'm glad to hear that that is something that you agree with. So more specifically to your practice, what are the kinds of things that you work on? I read a few of your representative matters, and I'd love to hear more about the types of things that you handle on a day-to-day basis, as well as some of the more longer-term projects that you take on.
On a day-to-day basis, I work, as I mentioned, with one company in particular that's a real estate portfolio company and owns about 50 buildings throughout Manhattan. And as outside general counsel for that firm, I'm involved in the day-to-day operations of some 6,000 residential units, I suppose, and with ground floor commercial at almost all of those buildings. And what that involves is advising on any issue of the moment. know, we work with a number of other law firms for, you know, landlord-tenant matters and anything, personal injury, employment matters, you know, things that, you know, bear upon an operation of that size. So, much of my day-to-day, you know, is involved in with that particular client. But I also represent a couple of developers and that are active throughout the city, less active right now than in months past. But those projects that I've worked on for the developers have again called on the whole toolkit, you know, meaning that, you know, a developer, for instance, is looking at a site or an assemblage or some other piece of real estate that they want to turn into something else. And I've been called in over the years at the diligence phase to take a look at, what issues bear on the property. Generally, looking first at tenancies, who's in place, who is physically there, any rent regulatory issues that might bear on this piece of real estate. Generally, I don't get involved in zoning. I have other counsel that I rely on, for those issues, because it is so specialized. But we will look at a project like that. Generally, if the client is still interested in going forward, we will advise then on the actual purchase of the property and, take a look at, what sort of reps and warranties we need from the seller, in order to feel safe in placing an investment there. And a lot of times then the next phase will be repositioning the property so that it's ready for development. And as a practical matter, what that's meant over the years is to go from a tenanted property to a vacant property. And so hopefully you have a pathway to that, because if you don't, it's not going to go anywhere. And that can mean a lot of things. It can mean contending with rent regulatory claims. And that's how I came at a certain expertise in the law, because for particularly commercial and industrial properties that have individuals, artists in particular, residing in them, there can be valuable rent regulatory rights that attach to those tenancies. And so through the lens of development, that's how I've become involved in that area of law, because sometimes there are developers who purchase properties and they believe that the property is suitable for one thing and it turns out that it's being used in a different way. And that's not always observable at either the diligence stage or really until the property is in control of a new purchaser. So that's been a particular area for me, both development and then loft and rent regulatory issues. I've, since early in my career, I've also worked in commercial litigation and real estate litigation. I think the balance of my practice these days is probably 60-40 favoring litigation, and the balance of it is advisory work and some light transactional. I handle a few commercial leases every year and participate in various ways in real estate dispositions and other sorts of transactions, operating agreement review, things of that nature, which is important to understanding the deals that I'm involved with, as they proceed. And sometimes they proceed toward litigation. So, having a view to the bones of a deal is really critical in that sense. But as far as litigation goes, I've litigated basically anything that touches on real estate, in one way or the other, from complex lease disputes to foreclosures to particularly LLC and partnership member disputes. And those don't always find their way to the courts, but the pivotal cases in my career have been of that nature, because there's usually an underlying asset and parties vying for control. And that's when the litigation gets to be the most fun, because there's something at the heart of it, and it justifies the cost and the effort.
Is there any particular, I didn't put this in the list of questions I sent you, but now I'm really curious, is there any particular case that you said that these are fun, these are interesting cases when there's an underlying asset. Is there any particular case you can kind of speak to or talk about that was fun for you, or that particularly sticks out?
I can. The one of those cases, which I'd characterize as a business divorce, is actually, I mean, if you look at my bio, there's a link to a decision there. That's a 55 page memorandum decision from now retired Justice Ramos in the commercial division. And that case involved a building in the West Village. It's at Sheridan Square. It's a big pre-war, beautiful building. And the nature of that dispute had to do with my clients who represented the majority in interest in the LLC and versus sort of a disaffected minority member. The litigation itself involves sort of jockeying for control over that entity. And as far as an exercise in lawyering goes, I think this is a fun example of, you know, what can be brought to bear, because before, you know, even years before we were involved in the litigation, we had developed a strategy and looked at all of the documents and understood them. And so that's more in the realm of corporate law than anything else. They're knowing how an entity is supposed to work and what you can do with it is, you know, is critical even before you start litigating on behalf of that entity or on behalf of any of its principals. And we ended up then in a commercial division action with a companion dissolution proceeding that was filed by the other side. And we butted heads for a couple of years there. For a judge like Justice Ramos, who was very well known for ruling from the bench, it was an aberration that we ended up with this very long piece of writing that, you know, on the whole, you know, was favorable to us, and also then precipitated a mediation at the appellate division that ended up producing a settlement on basically, you know, we called it a napkin agreement because it was, you know, handwritten on a, you know, a piece of paper. And you know, that then in turn led to a very complicated transaction that took place over the span of the next, you know, 18 months or so. And that sequence, you know, drew, you know, on all, basically every group of my firm in some sense. You know, we had at, you know, one point in time we had 15 attorneys, I think, you know, that were actively involved in this, and you know, because there were tax matters and because there were real estate transactional matters, there were all the litigators and, you know, the corporate folks, you know, were involved as well. So, you know, that was, you know, when I think about, and as I said, pivotal cases in my career, that was one, because that was my client, my case, my strategy. And, you know, it ended up, you know, at a point, you know, that, you know, everybody, I think everybody involved, even the other side, would consider that a, you know, successful transaction ultimately, you know. But, you know, sometimes as my adversary in that case said at one point in time, sometimes you got to give each other brain damage, you know, before you can get to the table and actually get something done.
Exactly. I like that. Sometimes you got to do a little brain damage before you can come to the table. That's
it's absolutely true. And I think you see that, or I've seen that over the years in the real estate context quite a bit, because there are often, it starts out as not just about money. You know, people have passions for properties in which they're involved, and that can be, you know, whether it's ownership or even management. Somebody who's been involved, you know, with the property, you know, for a few decades, feels really close to it, you know, because there is this physical thing at the bottom of it, and so I think with that undertone, sometimes to get to a business decision, you know, people need to be disabused of some notions that they might have, and that might take a little bit of litigating. And, you know, it's not always a strongly worded lawyer's letter is not always enough. You know, sometimes the courts need to be involved, and actually, you know, that third party perspective, you know, coming from the judiciary can be a powerful argument in favor of not leaving matters to the court and actually dictating your own path, through a settlement or through a transaction, whatever the case may be.
Right. And I think that ties nicely into my next question, which is, what are some of the challenges that you've experienced in your practice? Because I'm sure with all of the brain damage and the litigating and the adversarial proceedings, I'm sure that you've encountered some challenges, and I'd love to hear more about those and how you overcame them.
I think it's an interesting question, because I think the nature of litigation and dispute-based lawyering in general, everything is a challenge, and so I think it's really easy to run that stress level really high, and burn out on that. So I think that might be one of the factors over the course of my career now I guess 14 years since I've been out of Fordham, has been learning to detach from what can be very contentious matters and being able to leave work at work. It's more difficult now that everybody's at home. This is not my my office in Manhattan. So, but I wish it were, but it's not. But that detachment, I think, it was really critical, being able to compartmentalize and leave work at work. And that also leads to dispassionate decision-making, which can be, really important when advising clients. Because it's very easy to get drawn in by a client's position and then not be aware of how that position really interacts with reality, and particularly when you have judges involved who are looking at two sides who are very polarized often. The impulse is to draw a line down the middle. A lot of the times it's really important that you're not affected so much so by your own client's position, by this duty of zealous advocacy that we have, that we're not capable of giving dispassionate advice and saying, here's the downside, these are your chances of success, this is what might happen. And I think over the course of a career, I'd like to think, and this is all still a work in progress, mind you. Everybody is learning every day. It's practicing for a reason, right? So that I think has been, one of the challenges, from the outset of, starting out as a very young attorney, hot under the collar, with many a chip on my shoulder, to the point where I am now. I'd like to think that I've gotten better at that, leaving passions out of it, being able to, play the long game in a lot of respects. But as far as specific career obstacles that have come up, I started out working for a couple of boutique shops, and for me on an individual basis or a personal basis, I think starting out that way and having to sort of scrap my way along and learn accountability and not have everything handed to me has been a sort of career defining trip for me. That's I don't know if that's as much an obstacle as it is just the path that I've charted, but for me I needed that, and I think I can look back now and know that, which I feel pretty positive about in the scheme of things.
Right. So you spoke a little bit about dispassionate advice and how that's something you've had to learn over the course of your career, and removing yourself from those really contentious and really passionate issues. And I'm wondering, what else do you think is important for especially young lawyers, law students who are, as you say, hot under the collar, ready to go, ready to be passionate? What other advice do you have for those students who are so excited to get out into the law field? And if they're interested in real estate law specifically, what kind of advice do you have for them?
The general advice is you just got to cool it, right? The career is a, notwithstanding that we're living through slow motion, boring apocalypse or whatever, these last 8 months are, it's a long career, right? And the early years of it, you've got to work hard and you've got to learn a lot. And so listening and learning and being you know, knowing when it's appropriate to really, you know, push your own position is, you know, is very important. I think early in a career, it's most important to learn and to listen. As you know, as far as real estate law goes, I think, you know, for anybody who's starting out and, you know, wants to go into that field, I do think that having friends in the industry helps. that's you know, just for starters, you know, so that is, you know, if I think it's you know, there's several business books that basically say, you know, start out by being rich, you know, that's a great way to make money, right? You know, but you know, this is sort of advice along, you know, those lines is, you know, if you have contacts in the real estate area, you know, it's, you know, though, you know, that's a good place to start because you can get the introductions that you might need. And, you know, if, you know, depending on what you want to do in real estate, if you want to, you know, work in transactional real estate, you should go try for positions or, you know, internships that expose you to real estate transactions. If you want to work on, you know, real estate litigation, you know, go work with real estate litigators. And, you know, that can mean, you know, broadening your attack in the job application process. So you're not just looking at, you know, I'm going to apply to 10 white shoe firms, you know, and get whatever I get. And it, you know, then maybe, I don't know that it's like this these days, but, you know, when I was coming out of law school, you know, many people that I knew back then, you know, ended up, you know, burning out of big law really quick because they ended up basically in basements looking, you know, doing doc review, right? You know, for 15 hours a day. And that's not, you know, that's, I can understand why people burn out of law practice, you know, if they do that. But, you know, when I say broadening the scope, I mean, you know, apply to mid-sized firms, boutique firms, and, you know, actually look for, you know, do your research and figure out, you know, people who are, you know, within this industry operating, you know, at a high level, you know, people that you might actually want to work with. And finding a mentor is key. And I've been very fortunate that I've had excellent mentors throughout my career. And I still have excellent mentors, you know, because I think, you know, really, you know, at, you know, 14 years out, 39 years old, you know, it's still the early stage of, you know, my career. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot to do between now and whenever I retire and, you know, move out of practice. So, you know, that's, you know, having that wisdom above you is absolutely key, and, you know, recognizing it and being prepared to listen to it is also key.
Gotcha. Thank you so much, Mr. Reed. That was really helpful advice. And I'm sure it's very helpful for students who feel like it's either one thing or the other, and there's no in between, because we all know people like that. And unfortunately, or fortunately, there are a lot of options out there for students to consider, and you've given them a lot to consider in this interview, so I really appreciate it. For everyone else, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. I hope you will tune in next time for FBLA in Conversation. Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Sydney.